there was this thing that happened recently in Indiana having to do with reimbursement rates for behavioral health. And it got the attention of the therapist community in the state, even sort of got the attention of some non-therapists. And the gist is that a major insurer in the state, as part of a merger with a new billing organization, reportedly sent therapists on their network a revised contract that said reimbursement rates would be altered. And this kind of thing happens. It actually happens a lot. But here's the part that got people talking. The new rate was apparently going to be cut almost in half. Previously, $115 for a 53-minute session. The new contract rate was $65. And a lot of therapists were saying, I can't do this anymore. This is way too big of a cut, which makes sense. Who could afford an almost 50% salary reduction? One of the therapists who was going to be impacted by this new contract is named Joshua Terhune. He also happens to have a TikTok account that has a very large following, and he started making videos about all this. Here's one of the first ones he posted.
I'm probably breaking my contract by telling you this, but I need to say it. Anthem of Indiana just made a move that shows exactly where their priorities are, and it's not with you. So here's what's going on. A few months ago, I get a certified letter in the mail, and it's from Anthem. They're merging their billing with a new company called Carelon Behavioral Health. At first, I thought, it's just a rebrand, who cares? But then 2 weeks ago, an email came through on a Friday at 4:55 p.m. with a 69-page contract. And in itty-bitty little letters, it explained exactly what they're doing. They're trying to slash what they pay for therapy in Indiana by almost 50%. 50. Now, they're trying to hide it through a rebrand, and they're trying to call it some sort of miscommunication, and they're promising a new contract. But therapists in Indiana, we're not buying it. Because other therapists in Michigan and in New York, they've said the exact same thing has happened to them. One therapist is now being forced to pay back over $10,000 to Anthem because they decided that they were overpaid and they used a Carelon contract that she never signed. When insurances pull this, we can't afford to be in their network. We've got student loans, office rent, families. We're forced to leave. We can't accept that. But who gets hurt most of all because of this? It's you. Many therapists in Indiana, we plan on dropping Anthem. So your access to quality therapists gets lower and lower. So now you know the secret. Share this with other people so that they can know too. And let me know your feelings in the comments. Thanks.
Here's another post that happened later.
Indiana therapist, if you are affected by the Anthem Carelon contract shenanigans, we are hosting a town hall meeting tomorrow, Wednesday, from noon to 1, where we will be asking them some questions. I have a good feeling my mouth's going to get me in trouble. And honestly, I'm okay with that. I've made my peace with it. Some things are more important than being polite. So stay tuned. I've also got permission from the people that are leading this. And again, thank you to all of you. I really appreciate it. You can join our Facebook page if you haven't already, or you can reach out to me and we will gladly give you that information.
Cutting now to yet another post Joshua made. This one has a caption that reads in part, I'm sharing an actual conversation I had with representatives during a town hall meeting. They're either really bad at writing contracts or they're lying to us. I think I know which one it is.
Yeah, I'm Joshua Terhune. I am a solo private practice owner, and I plan on going out of network with Carelon if this is not resolved in our contract. Many therapists are leaving Anthem because you're cutting our rates from $115 to $65 per session. And you're hiding behind contracts that say applicable fee schedule without showing us the actual numbers. So it looks like they sent the complaint department to absorb our anger while the actual decision makers are probably on a golf course somewhere. But since you're the ones here, you can take this question back to whoever actually has the power.
Last video I'll play that Joshua recorded, this one is captioned, I got an update, but It's a whole lot of nothing.
Well, that was fast because I already have an update for you. I just got an email from Carillon confirming that our pay rate won't decrease. But it's not what they said that concerns me. It's what they've left unsaid. So in the new contract with Carillon, they say on page one that my contract with Anthem is deleted and it's replaced with this new one. And in the fee schedule, they give very detailed information on the rates for Carillon and New York City employees for some reason. But then for Anthem, it has a few lines where it says applicable fee schedule. But if you remember what I said, they deleted the previous contract. So there is no Anthem fee schedule anymore. So if they pay me, hypothetically speaking, $65 for a session, and I say, hey, Carillon, you didn't pay me my contracted rate. They'll look at me and they'll say, what contract? We already told you that we deleted that contract and replaced it with this one, and you agreed to it. So I'm not even considering signing anything until I see cold, hard numbers in my contract with what I'm going to be paid. So thank you for supporting this fight for accessible mental health care for Hoosiers.
I'm Tobin Richardson, a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by providing a forever free podcast-style platform designed for learning. Here, taking a look at insurance reimbursement for mental health providers and how it aligns with ethics. A lot of therapists who I've talked to about this topic have told me that they think of the enmeshment of behavioral health with insurance as a can't live with them, can't live without them type of relationship. Because, of course, we may often not like or agree with insurance provider practices or contracts in totality. But the reality is that many clients do expect to be able to use their health insurance to pay for services, at least in part. There are some, and actually a growing number of therapists, who are able to retain a full caseload through cash pay only, in other words, outside of this insurance system. But most aren't, and even if they could, it would mean providing access to fewer and likely a wealthier pool of clients in their community. And so they sometimes accept conditions or reimbursement rates that they don't love, don't seem fair. You're going to hear an interview I did with Rachel Kimbrell, who's a therapist who talked to me about one of the ways insurance reimbursement has impacted her practice, which honestly wasn't on my radar when I started exploring this topic. And that's what happens when clients ask about the specifics of how their insurance applies to our services. And as anyone who accepts insurance knows, that can be complicated. She doesn't always know with 100% certainty, despite her best efforts to try to figure it out. And that can have an impact on the therapeutic relationship. Here she is.
One of the biggest issues I've had is that I look up a person's benefits, but the information will be different or confusing or wrong. Like, I've had it be completely wrong before. And so then that creates an issue with a client thinking they're only going to pay so much, and then the insurance returns saying, or the claim returns saying, you actually owe more. Like, I wish there was a system that would say, like, you look up a benefit, you have your EIN and your MPI, and it just says you are in network and this is what the client will pay, and they have this much of their deductible left, but this is exactly how much they'll pay until the deductible is met. And then when the deductible is met, it'll be this much. But there's nothing that's just as clear as that. And so much of the benefits information is vague. So sometimes the issue can be that the client can't afford to pay what they actually need to pay. But I feel like I have to spend a lot of energy explaining to clients and just always kind of like having that nervousness in the back of my head that the benefit information I shared with them is wrong. I wish I didn't have to think about that. Like, I'd say the energy spent on figuring out what the actual benefit is and then resolving a claim that's not paid or comes back partially paid or something like that. And then having to be on the phone and get like bumped around a lot and be on hold a long time and talking to someone that doesn't understand the system. It's just energy I wish I could put into meeting with my clients, being a better therapist. And, you know, as a private practice clinician, I'm not getting paid for those hours. So that's stressful too, to have so much time and energy going into something you're not getting paid for. We are not in control of what insurance pays, what the client's benefits are, things like that. But we're the face that the client sees when we're sharing the information. So I try so hard. And this is something I had to, again, learn through trial and error. I try so hard to be as upfront as possible in the beginning to explain this is a confusing process. Sometimes the claim comes back different than what I see the benefits as when I look it up in the provider portal. It's not easy to get accurate information all the time. So I try to explain to everybody so there's less repair work that's needed. But as I learned through trial and error, there's definitely some people who feel like what I assume they think I'm scamming them or trying to charge them more than what they're supposed to pay. And it feels like they're blaming me when I'm not the one in charge of approving a claim and deciding benefits and things like that. So in the past, there have been people that have been really upset and just quit services, which makes me sad for them because, again, everybody I feel like deserves to have access to mental health support. When there's issues now, I find that most people are understanding when I'm really upfront about it, but there are still occasionally people who are upset about it. And so a lot of times I just kind of let it go. Like I have to determine, is it worth my time and energy to pester this person, or is it worth it to just let it go? Which is also unfortunate on our end to not get paid what we're supposed to get paid. But I do tend to prioritize the client rapport and well-being, and I'll do things like set up a payment plan or something like that to help people because I want to be accessible.
Being a private practice therapist, especially one that's doing billing and insurance claims on your own, is so complicated, way more than it seems like it should be. And like Rachel talked about, a lot of therapists feel the responsibility to understand it and pay the price, literally, sometimes when its complexity is too impossible to navigate. I want to play you another interview I did with a therapist who has also thought a ton about the intersection of insurance and ethics. She wrote about it on her website, which caught my attention, because she had this unique lens on the topic that I hadn't heard before, but it painted a picture I thought was important to share. And as a heads up, one of the topics Katie talks about focuses on the history of mental health parity and its impact on therapists and mental health care. And in case you're not familiar with this topic, quick rundown. Before 2008, there was a pretty different landscape for how insurance and mental health care intersected. And that's because health insurance plans often either didn't cover mental health services or covered them differently, sometimes with an entirely different structure. So, for example, capping the number of sessions that could be covered within a plan. But then around this time, a couple big pieces of legislation changed the system drastically. The first of these was called the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. It required large group insurance plans to treat mental health benefits on par with other benefits. It didn't require that health insurance plans offered mental health coverage, but rather it just said if they did, they needed to be at parity or equal to other medical benefits. And then, fast forward a couple years later, the Affordable Care Act extended parity protections. And it did this by requiring even individual and small plans to include mental health and substance use disorder services as one of the 10 what was called essential health benefits. And again, these pieces of legislation had real impacts really quickly. They ensured millions of people gained mental health coverage with equal copays and deductives as their physical health plans, and stopped things like session caps, which, by the way, still happen through benefits like employee assistance programs, so that people could generally get ongoing treatment if they needed it. But then there were other impacts too that were maybe unintended or unexpected. And one of those was that all of a sudden, the big overarching heaping bag of financial issues that impacted healthcare costs in general, which, as we all know, are so often astronomical, also were now directly impacting mental health care because it was all covered in essentially the same way under the same plans. And when Katie thinks about the ethics of insurance reimbursement, this is an aspect she thinks about. Like, did those parity rules really serve therapists and mental health care in general? Or did it just entangle us further in a system that was so broken? Here she is.
Therapy for me is a second career. So I was in business before, and one of my roles over the years was in HR. And so I think I came into being a therapist knowing a lot about how benefits are processed. I know much more today from the provider side than I did back then. But because I came from that HR background, I did know what I was getting into. At that time, because the Affordable Care Act had just been passed, it was very new to have mental health parity. And so at that time, insurance companies had not done strategic things to limit benefits. And so it really seemed at the beginning of my insurance journey that it was the ethical thing to enable access by contracting with as many insurance companies as possible. I was picky about reading through each contract to understand what that would mean in terms of clawbacks, and certainly all of those contracts from insurance companies are going to be weighted in favor of the insurance company, but it gave me the ability to be able to look through the contracts and the rates and make a decision about the ones I was willing to panel with. But I would say I was much more willing to panel with companies that had lower rates and more restrictive terms at that point than I would be today. I think that there is much more reluctance now to panel with insurance companies, and that a lot of people do see it as a black and white decision of either I'm paneled with a bunch, I get burned, and the solution is therefore panel with absolutely no one. I'm not sure if that's helpful to clients or to counselors. I think first of all, read your contracts very carefully. It is worth it sometimes to bring that third party payer into a relationship with you and a client, both for the sake of the client and for the sake of your practice. I kind of make the analogy of, like, I'm on a high risk breast cancer screening protocol. And in order to get insurance to pay for any of that and to even know that that was, like, possible for me, like, I had to hand over genetic material and a whole lot of personal health information to my insurance, which is now floating around, you know, the insurance world somewhere saying that I'm on this. And in part, that's because I can't afford to pay out of pocket for those tests. I can't afford to pay out of pocket for an MRI every year. I can't afford to do that plus a mammogram. So somebody is going, you know, if I want the insurance company to pay for it, I have to give them information to prove that it's necessary. And there's a third party in that decision about whether that gets authorized every year. And I don't love that, but that's the service that they're providing. Try to think bigger than just the relationship between you and this patient. Try to think about the whole system. And that's the reason that you might be being told no. And ultimately, parity has been wonderful for mental health and horrible for mental health. It's been wonderful in that, you know, in 2006, I was paying $170 a session, you know, to a psychologist to see someone for like a few months after a breakup, and my plan covered absolutely nothing. So, like, that's awesome that now health insurance is covering mental health. But parity has caused some problems too, because we can't afford for every single person on a plan to be in weekly therapy forever at a high rate. I think that publicly traded companies in particular, which most insurance companies are, certainly have a profit incentive and certainly are overpaying their executives and all the things that you hear complaints about, particularly within, you know, we're generally a liberal and or progressive group. Many counselors and therapists are. And so we see these things and we see this as like a manifestation of inequality. And it is those things. And at the same time, it is also that we have a hugely complex and uncoordinated healthcare system that these insurance companies are also trying to navigate in terms of this person's total cost to the insurance company. I mean, the whole idea with insurance, if we back it up and we take it to, you know, like it's kind of historical purpose was we're going to pool our resources as members so that when any given member experiences a health event, we will cover that. And so there's an assumption that people kind of within the pool are going to be in aggregate using slightly less than their actual spend on average. So if we look at the entire population of, let's say, United Healthcare or something, they need to take in more premiums than they are paying out in benefits. We can argue about how much of that is going to profit, and I agree that that's problematic, but I don't think profit is the only problem. The other problem is the tens of thousands of other contributors to healthcare costs in our country. Part of that is tort. So, and this could definitely go on like a ridiculously weird tangent for me. Like, we have really high liability insurance premiums for medical providers that then get passed on to patients because we have completely unrestricted tort laws in our country. And so you, if you are injured by a provider, you can sue for a ton of money, and that adds to what the insurance company is paying. We've got drug companies, of course, they also want to make a profit. We have you know, huge issues with the budgeting around end of life care, and I mean, because the whole system is broken, we feel these pressures as mental health providers that feel very specific to us. Like, why would you not want to pay for my, you know, 1 45-minute session a week? It's not, you know, it's not contributing that much to the healthcare system. But if you are, you know, multiplying that across everyone, across every medical specialty, ultimately the insurance companies do have a duty to be able to pool resources and use them well so that there's enough to, you know, to pay for everyone's care. And that isn't just mental health. That's also the rest of healthcare spend. So there's a lot of really complicated social issues to talk through to figure out how to fix that. Most of the conversations we're not willing to have. And so, like, I think that being able to understand the larger climate will help you come up with more effective solutions for deciding how you want to engage with insurance.
Yeah. Can you say more about that? Like, what are some of the conversations you think we really should be having here?
I think one of the most painful conversations in the healthcare space overall is the amount that we spend on end of life care. And that's where the whole, you know, like death panel conversation has come up, right? Like, how could we possibly want to limit that when, and how would we ever want to put restrictions on folks who want to live as long as possible? I mean, that's such a painful conversation. I can't imagine anybody being able to sit down and talk through that without probably a lot of tears and anger. And, you know, as a society, we are somewhat individualistic, and you see a very different approach to death and dying here compared to in places like Japan, where we've had some very interesting interactions with patients in those hospitals, where folks are actually aware of how much their hospitalization is costing the larger economy and make care decisions for themselves based on the collective, which is just completely different than we have here. And so it's not a conversation we can have well in our culture, easily in our culture. And it is one that that they're having other places. And it's just a very taboo subject. But then we also have the issue of, like, within the mental health care space on its own, to be able to say, who needs weekly individual therapy? When is the end date for that? To be like, I hate the idea that, like, I should be able to get through a 12 session protocol for OCD. No way. There's definitely folks that that need way, way, way longer than that. And when you see someone whose insurance is paying for therapy week after week for a decade, the question is what's the end point of that? But I think that we don't acknowledge that there are limited resources for our services.
Katie went on to convey how even though insurance navigation can feel overwhelming, especially with the limited time and resources available to many therapists, she does sometimes advocate for both specific clients with insurance companies and then for clients in general through avenues like professional organizations, all of course without sharing personal health information. And other therapists can do this too in a few specific ways, like by arming our clients with language to approach their insurance companies themselves, knowing what types of services an insurer must provide in order to meet their fiduciary duties to members, or in the case of self-funded plans, when the employer is paying directly for health coverage and just paying an insurer to administer the plan, in which case the employer can essentially make their own rules about what's covered. In this case, by talking to the client about advocating for mental health services with that employer directly, they may be able to convince them of how critical coverage of specific services can be. There are also times when working with our local professional organizations or lobbyists can really be the best strategy, like when we notice loopholes or gaps in state legislation. One of the overarching feelings that came up for a lot of therapists I talked with about the impact of insurance reimbursements on their practice was kind of this sense of powerlessness, like the insurance companies have all the ability to do whatever they want for the most part, and beyond opting out of the system altogether, which usually doesn't seem like a feasible strategy, there's not much else we're able to do, which, okay, is maybe a little bit of an overstatement, but I do get the sentiment. And that's especially because of this one last variable that I think is important to talk through with this topic, and that's antitrust laws, which prevent independent contractors, which most private practice therapists are, from banding together to negotiate payment rates with insurers. These federal antitrust laws have been on the books for a while, actually, across administrations, which in essence say that if this type of collective bargaining were allowed, it would unfairly drive up prices for consumers. There are some exceptions and nuances to what's allowed state by state, but it's muddy terrain for sure, and we need to tread it carefully. So yeah, there's a lot of forces that do feel like a weight, limiting our control to take action, even if we feel like insurance contracts are not developed in good conscience or fairness. But there are things that are clearly allowable and totally inbounds as well. We can advocate through professional organizations, even though those organizations even have to be careful to avoid price discussions. And as we know, unlike many other professions, therapist organizations are scattered amongst provider types, like social workers and counselors and psychologists, which may hinder our collective power. Like Kate talked about, you can also lobby legislative and regulatory powers, and can and should, of course, be informed as a voter of the stance of your representatives. Another thing you can do is just on-the-ground communication, like Joshua did. He made sure therapists in his community understood that a contract was changing and tried to be sure that those around him got what those changes were. And he voiced that he personally wasn't all right with them. And that's all fair. I'd say that's very important. In this case, at least as of now, it seems like it's worked. The rate hasn't been reduced yet. So maybe that's a coincidence and has nothing to do with him voicing his concerns, but I doubt it. So stay tuned. Sometimes our efforts may just pay off.